Thank you. Welcome. On behalf of the appellant, Richard Sternberg, I'd like to introduce to the court Kevin Rayfield from the firm of Petrogallo, Gordon, Alfano, Bosick, and Responti in Philadelphia. He will make the argument on behalf of the appellant.
Welcome to the court.
Also seated at council table is Christopher Iacona, also from that firm.
Welcome. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Kevin Rayfield on behalf of appellant Dr. Richard Sternberg. First, thank you for permitting me to appear today on behalf of the appellant. This is an appeal from a Superior Court order granting defendant's motion for summary judgment, denying plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on defendant's counterclaim count 2, seeking fees under the Health Care Quality Improvement Act, and also appealing the order of the Superior Court granting attorney's fees under the Health Care Quality Improvement Act. It is appellant's position the court erred in several ways. First of all, the court used and applied an incorrect standard of law on summary judgment. The court, on page 48 of its order, cited the correct standard. That is a rational juror looking at the evidence of record could find in favor of the non-moving party, in this case plaintiff, because of the Health Care Quality Improvement Act burden shifting provision. But when it applied the facts to the law, it applied the incorrect standard. It treated the facts as though the court was sitting as a bench trial. And initially, instead of finding whether a rational juror could conclude that the defendants were unreasonable in to the two prongs of the Health Care Quality Improvement Act, whether there was a reason to believe there was imminent danger or whether they made a reasonable effort to obtain the facts, the court required plaintiff to convince the Superior Court that the defendants were unreasonable, which is a different standard. And in applying that incorrect standard, the Superior Court also erred in several other ways. In looking at the facts, the court ignored many of the facts of record, particularly that testimony of the MEC defendants when they testified at the time they continued the precautionary suspension in this case, that they did not believe at the time that Dr. Sternberg posed any imminent danger. And at the time they continued the precautionary suspension, they did not believe that Dr. Sternberg posed any imminent danger in the future. He also made some credibility determinations when there was a disputed issues of fact. For instance, and I'll get to this as I move forward, Mr. Werner, who imposed the precautionary suspension, testified that he had received the information that he'd used to make his decision from two people, Dr. Paul Castro, Vice President of Medical Affairs at Nanticoke, and Mary Beth Wade, who was in charge of nursing. Both of those two were deposed, and both Ms. Wade and Dr. Paul Castro denied ever doing any investigation or providing any information to Mr. Werner. But yet the court below gave the more weight to Mr. Werner's testimony rather than looking at the evidence in light most favorable to Dr. Sternberg, the non-moving party. Furthermore, the court erred by substituting its judgment for that of the defendants. The MEC defendants, as I indicated, had testified that when they decided to continue the precautionary suspension in this case, they did not look at the bylaws. They did not consider imminent danger. Imminent danger was an issue that they were considering, that they had only decided to continue the precautionary suspension because Dr. Sternberg had violated a July letter imposing a strict standard that he couldn't cross the line and be any disruptive any further. And they also testified that they did not believe that Dr. Sternberg may pose an imminent danger to the patient's safety in the future. However, the court, in its opinion, substituted its own judgment for that of the doctors, discounted their testimony as being, in hindsight, when they were asked.
Now, when you say the defendants and the doctors, are you talking about the members of the peer review committee, or are you talking about the CEO of the hospital or the hospital itself, and you say the defendants?
I apologize, Mr. Steele. In that instance, the MEC defendants, the physicians who sat in the medical executive committee, testified when they were deposed.
All right, I may have just have misheard you.
I apologize.
I understand now.
Thank you. Further, the court substituted its own judgment. Rather than giving credence to the testimony of the MEC defendants, he instead decided that he believed that there was enough evidence to find that Dr. Sternberg posed imminent danger to the health and safety of a patient if he was not suspended, which is improper. Furthermore, the court applied an incorrect analysis when it came to the determination of disruptive behavior. With the court's permission, I'll address each one in turn. First of all, the court fashioned the question below as to whether a physician's disruptive behavior could ever be the basis of a finding of imminent danger. Once the court found it in the affirmative, he failed to apply the facts of this particular case to that standard. And what I mean by that, Justices, is that he did not account for the testimony of the MEC defendants, who clearly testified that they didn't believe that Dr. Sternberg posed any imminent danger. He also...
Can I stop you? There's clearly a standard that there be an imminent danger a possibility of an imminent danger of harm, right? Is that the language?
Justice Berger, it is if failure to suspend may cause imminent danger to the health or safety of an individual in the future.
Right. May cause.
Yes.
So it doesn't necessarily have to, but it's a possibility, right?
It's more than a mere possibility. It's imminent danger, which means...
Yeah, but only may cause imminent danger. You know, you've got two somewhat conflicting words in there, because if it's imminent danger, you would think that there can be no doubt about it. But on the other hand, the language of it says may cause imminent danger, which suggests that it's a situation where who knows, but it may cause imminent danger, and therefore we're within our rights. But forgetting that for the moment, I understand from what's in the briefs and what I've looked at that there is case law that says disruptive behavior can qualify as being something that may cause imminent danger. And I guess what I'd like to hear is what constitutes disruptive behavior, because it seems to me you could have quite a range from somebody who showed up in a clown suit because he thought that would be a cute thing to do, and everybody else said, no, that wasn't cute, that was disruptive, or somebody who shows up impaired, physically or mentally impaired, and is unable to carry out a procedure. So what does it mean to be disruptive for purposes of this statute?
Well, for purposes of the statute, Your Honor, I would say two things. First of all, there's a district court case, Strzynski, which addresses that particular question. Because disruptive behavior is first defined by the hospital and encompasses such a broad range of behavior, from speaking loudly to actually endangering a patient, the Strzynski court imposed a first threshold question, and that is whether the disruptive behavior that the hospital alleges caused problems, caused an imminent danger in the present. And then it looked to, if that disruptive behavior caused an imminent danger in the present, would failure to suspend that physician who was engaged in that behavior cause imminent danger in the future? And that works perfectly in a situation where the only complaint by the hospital is alleged disruptive behavior. It's one thing if the...
Okay, well, wait a second. This case that you're relying on, is that the state of the law on this federal statute, or is that just a case that, you know, you like the way they phrased it?
Your Honor, we've reviewed most, if not all, the federal cases that address the imminent danger standard in the Health Care Quality Improvement Act. The Strzynski case, which was decided several months before oral argument last year, was the first case that we found that addressed the particular issue of disruptive behavior that didn't deal with an impaired physician, someone who was drunk, who was incompetent, or who was under the influence of drugs or alcohol. So that's why we addressed the Strzynski test, because in our initial briefing to the court below, we were making a very similar argument to what the court in Strzynski found, which is that since disruptive behavior encompasses such a wide range of behaviors, that you have to look at the actual facts of the physician's behavior and determine whether that behavior itself caused any injury at the present, and whether failure to suspend would cause injury or imminent danger in the future. Now, imminent danger means that the harm is imminent. And in Strzynski, the facts, I think, are illustrative. There, a physician who was alleged to be disruptive actually entered into an operating room and took a metal shield from an operating room that was in use. That metal shield is protecting both the providers, the physician and nursing staff, and the patient from the surgery tool that was being used. So there, that act, taking a necessary piece of medical equipment, was or did pose an imminent danger at the time. And therefore, the staff was able to say, if we don't stop this behavior in the future, and the physician continues along those lines, it may cause imminent danger in the future.
How does your client's conduct fall with, you know, by comparison?
Your Honor, my client, Dr. Sternberg's conduct here that's alleged, which is that he went through the proper procedures, had a form filled out, had it signed, had the reporter properly equipped to be sterile, who was trained in sterility techniques like any other observer in the hospital, because there is actually a procedure at Nanticoke to allow observers into the OR. So it's something that's done often. And then having that person observe a surgery posed no risk whatsoever.
Well, aren't there two facts that are important to analyzing that? The first is he was told not to conduct any form of political campaign on the hospital grounds, and that there was reason to believe that this was an attempt to enhance his political future by inviting a newspaper reporter into the operating room. And secondly, there's an issue in the facts, as I see it, about a representation or at least a belief on the part of the rest of the medical personnel present at the time that the reporter was actually a medical student and not disclosed that he was a reporter at all. I don't know what observer means, but if I read the record correctly, it suggests that there was at least an implied, if not an explicit representation, that this was a bona fide observer in the sense that it was a medical student, somebody there to learn about the operation, not somebody there to enhance Dr. Sternberg's political future. Is that all wrong?
Justice Steele, in fact, when Dr. Sternberg brought the reporter into the OR, he introduced her to the staff as a reporter. So he was not hiding the fact that she was a reporter. He introduced the reporter to the staff as a reporter.
Well, and that's when she arrived.
That day
off,
that's
correct.
The
preparation and any acquiescence in her coming into the operating room itself. I mean, she's physically there and she's introduced. What are people going to do, say, we're not going to go through with the procedure until she leaves?
Well, Your Honor, the point is that her presence in the OR did not cause an imminent danger to anyone. Because there was a policy in place to allow observers, not just medical personnel, into the OR.
When she left the OR or was escorted out, did Dr. Sternberg go follow her out?
There was no evidence other than Mr. Werner's affidavit to that effect. I know that Mr. Werner's affidavit claims that he had heard that, but the reports by the people in the OR indicate that Dr. Sternberg never left the OR. Dr. Sternberg testified that he never left the OR, and there was no evidence other than Mr. Werner's statement to that effect.
Was he told before that incident not to use the hospital property to enhance his political career?
There was a dispute between Mr. Werner and Dr. Sternberg. Mr. Werner had indicated that he did not want Dr. Sternberg handing out buttons or campaign literature in the hospital. Dr. Sternberg wrote back and indicated that he disagreed. He thought that was an infringement by a nonprofit hospital of his First Amendment rights. But he desisted from the campaign buttons and the literature.
So the nonprofit hospital should run the risk of losing its nonprofit status by countenancing campaigning for a political party on its premises?
No, Your Honor. We're not suggesting that the hospital couldn't do what it had started to do initially in July.
Well, what is not disruptive about disobeying a direct order?
Well, Your Honor, we're not
only an institutional relic,
right,
who was in the Army, but it seems to me that there is a hierarchy in any institution, and when you're told do not use the hospital premises to enhance your campaign, it means something.
Your Honor, and I would not suggest, and I don't think we've ever suggested, that point of him bringing a reporter into the OR couldn't be perceived as disruptive. But what it is not, and there is no evidence of in this record, is that it was an imminent danger to the health or safety of any individual. The hospital had recourse under its bylaws and under the Health Care Quality Improvement Act. That recourse was to proceed with the procedure that was already in place, to have a hearing in November, and take away his privileges.
Wait a second. Am I correct that your client doesn't dispute that there were a series of incidents where other people described him as having been inappropriately angry or out of control or, you know, using foul language, things along those lines, that there was some acknowledgement that those types of incidents had occurred?
And in fact, Justice Berger, Dr. Sternberg was deposed by Mr. Hackett, and he was shown his alleged disruptive file. He discounted having known about some of the complaints against him and rejected that his conduct was as described in some of the others.
Are you saying that he totally denied that he ever had an outburst or ever spoke too loud or inappropriately angry at someone or anything like that?
No, Justice Berger, Dr. Sternberg did not deny that in the past, when making complaints about the nursing staff or about making complaints because it wasn't the proper equipment in the emergency room that was needed, that he did not speak in a loud voice and somewhat angrily at times.
Okay, well, what I'm getting at is this. We've got, from this record at least, a doctor who has some problems with maintaining decorum in the hospital setting, to the point that the committee tells him, you know, you just can't continue this way. We can't have any more disruptive behavior. And he goes ahead and does something that he's specifically told he can't do with the reporter after having been warned. And in terms of the imminent threat of harm, isn't it reasonable to view somebody who is flouting authority and saying, I don't care what you tell me I have to behave like, I'm not going to. Isn't that in itself an indication that, you know, who knows what this guy is going to do next? He may be a threat of imminent harm because he refuses to comport with the standard of behavior that we expect of him.
Justice Berger, in this particular, the facts of this particular case, in the 9 years that Dr. Sternberg was at the hospital, at no time did he actually do anything based on his alleged disruptive behavior that caused physical harm to any patient. The hospital acknowledges that. The conduct at issue here, which is bringing a reporter into the OR, was not conduct that caused injury or danger to anyone. The operating staff wrote in their statements that they were not disrupted. The doctors and the medical executive committee, including the chief of surgery and the chief of trauma, testified that Dr. Sternberg was not in imminent danger at the time, and they didn't believe he posed an imminent danger in the future. And there are physicians who work with Dr. Sternberg on a daily basis. They imposed the precautionary suspension based on the July letter, which said if you cross the line, you're going to be suspended, a procedure which had no place in the bylaws. And they imposed the precautionary suspension because, as they say in their own words, he crossed the line one too many times. So they can take that action, but they're not afforded immunity under the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act unless they meet the standard, which is failure to suspend may cause imminent danger.
Defendants, how do you respond to the Superior Court's citation to the Jenkins case, Jenkins versus Methodist Hospitals of Dallas, Inc., where the hospital work environment was, according to that court, largely responsible, the physician, although there were issues of competence, was also largely responsible for a hostile work environment that was potentially injurious to patient care, and an indication that the physician made the staff feel rushed to perform their duties, causing them to fear mistakes. I mean, if physicians or surgeons are going into a environment in the operating room where one of the surgeons is potentially going to disrupt and distract them from their work, wouldn't they rush to get the job done and potentially make mistakes just to get out of there as soon as possible? Exactly what the Jenkins court was referring to.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, there's no evidence that that was the case. There's nothing in the OR staff statements that said that they were disrupted in any way by the presence of that reporter.
Well, can it be inferred that maybe it hadn't happened yet, but it would happen, it could happen in the future?
Your Honor, and that's why the Stranicki test imposed by the District Court in Nevada is of such import, because in a wide range of disruptive behaviors, Justice Berger notes, in order to determine whether disruptive behavior may be the type that may cause imminent danger if not stopped, you have to look to see what the alleged disruptive behavior did at the time. And here there was nothing that caused any disruption, nothing that caused any risk to the patients, and the physician MEC committees recognized that, as does Mr. Werner when he was cross-examined on the deposition. He testified he had no evidence, none whatsoever, to support any of the reasons he cited as for the basis of the precautionary suspension.
But they were obviously concerned about it because they told him not to do it ever again.
I'm sorry, do
they
what?
They were concerned about the potential effect of disruptive behavior because they told him to stop.
Stop the disruptive behavior?
Yes. That he would be suspended or privileges revoked.
Well, yes, Justice, and if they felt that he was acting outside of the procedures, then their proper recourse was to go through at the hearing in November, give Dr. Sternberg notice and a hearing, allow him to defend himself, answer the charges in July, which Dr. Policastro said were not worthy of discipline, and answer the charge in October. And none of the reasons that the hospital cited, either CEO Werner or the MEC for the precautionary suspension, were based on any evidence whatsoever.
But that hearing didn't happen by virtue of an agreement of the parties, is that so?
There was a resolution offered by the hospital that Dr. Sternberg come back, take a course on interpersonal relationships, that he then come back to the hospital, you have his privileges reinstated, and the precautionary suspension that was improperly opposed in October would be converted to a leave of absence.
Right. Now, you've been through your time and your rebuttal time.
Yes. Right?
And we never got to the attorney's fees issue, so we'll have to consider how we deal with that in a few minutes.
Yes, Justice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, my name is David Hackett. I'm the attorney for the defendants below, appellees. Dr. Sternberg, in his briefs and in his argument this morning, seeks to limit the scope of HCQIA immunity in misconduct-based cases to actions where there is proof demonstrating a link between the physician's disruptive behavior and harm or potential harm to patient health. This argument was made before the Third Circuit in the case of Gordon versus Lewistown Hospital, and the court rejected the argument. The court said there's nothing in the Health Care Quality Improvement Act that says there has to be actual harm or that there has to be proof that there's potential harm. There's nothing in the Health Care Quality Improvement Act which would make it more difficult for a hospital or a defendant to obtain immunity in cases of misconduct rather than incompetence. And they also said that this argument conflicts with the objective reasonableness standard that's applied by the courts in immunity cases. Now, the reasonable objectiveness standard is that you look at the total circumstances surrounding the matter and determine whether or not, based on those circumstances, the reviewers acted reasonably in imposing the, in this case, precautionary suspension.
Well, if that's true, the issue still remains, is that an appropriate summary judgment disposition, or is that a question of fact for a jury?
It's well settled that questions of immunity are issues of fact and are appropriately decided on summary judgment.
Well, questions of what's reasonable, sir, given all of the totality of the circumstances, are traditionally factual.
Well, that's the objective standard. It's an objective determination. It's not a subjective determination. Congress did not want that to happen. That's why the testimony of the MEC here that they didn't believe he was posed imminent danger is not relevant to this. The court looks at the...
Well, that may be the basis for an appropriate instruction to the jury, but how does it, on these facts, how does it become a question, simply a matter of law for the court to resolve at summary judgment, rather than having a jury determine, given the totality of the circumstances, whether objectively immunity should apply to these defendants?
It would seem to me that the purpose of the jury is to determine facts, which would include subjective beliefs, whereas the court, in deciding motion for summary judgment in an immunity case, can merely take an objective look at the facts that are in the record. In this case, the totality of the circumstances that leads up to the matter in question, and based on that objective review, make a determination that the reviewers acted reasonably.
Well, maybe I'm confused, but do you agree that the
facts... I think I'm the one who's confused.
No, do you agree that the facts that would determine whether or not immunity applied were completely undisputed, that there was no genuine issue of material fact that touched on the objective reasonableness of the action that would allow immunity to apply?
That's correct.
All right. Did the trial judge, in reaching the decision to grant summary judgment to the defendants, make a clear conclusion that all of the inferences were drawn in favor of the non-moving party? In other words, in Dr. Sternberg's favor?
Yes, he indicated that in his decision.
Well, based on what I've just heard from the presentation from your colleague, Dr. Sternberg disputed a number of the characterizations of instances of his conduct that relate to whether or not he should have been suspended based upon a theory that he constituted or may constitute an immediate threat to the hospital community or the welfare of a patient. Am I wrong to characterize their presentation in that way?
No, you're not wrong, Your Honor. Dr. Sternberg did dispute the complaints that were made against him.
Well, then why is that not relevant to denying a motion for summary judgment if they're material issues of fact in dispute?
Well, those aren't material issues of fact to the case at hand.
All right, tell us why not.
Well, the complaints were part of the circumstances that led to the decision of the reviewers.
Well, that's another area where let me interrupt just one more second, just to clear the cobwebs from my mind on this. Based on the earlier presentation, I got the idea that the imminent danger and the suspension that resulted from it flowed from one incident, and that is the reporter in the operating room, and that there were other incidents out there that could arguably constitute disruptive behavior, but they were not the basis for this suspension. Is that correct or incorrect?
The basis for this suspension was the incident in the operating room involving the reporter.
Was there no dispute of fact?
That was the disruptive behavior. There was no disputed facts about that particular incident. But both Mr. Werner and the MEC had this background information that they couldn't just reject when they were making their decision to suspend.
Maybe I'm plagued by the fact that I used to represent a hospital, so that consciousness of due process and opportunities to be heard before privileges are either suspended or revoked is very much on my mind. And let's assume there were other instances. In a regular course of business, don't you schedule a hearing? The hospital presents a case before the peer review committee, and at the hearing, the respondent doctor has an opportunity to dispute with knowledge in advance of the complaint against him, bring witnesses, other evidence. It's tried as if it's an administrative judicial proceeding, and then there's a rational result with fact-finding and a clear application of the law. But in the immediate suspensions, a doctor's privileges are touched upon, his reputation is touched upon, it's damaged theoretically not only in the hospital community but throughout the broader community, and has serious implications for his ability to practice. Now, what I'm trying to get at is what justifies the immediate suspension without a hearing if there's consideration beyond the operating room incident itself? How does it alone stand for the immediate suspension? And how do you drag in the other incidents as part of that when that's not what they relied upon for the immediate suspension?
The Healthcare Quality Improvement Act grants an exception to the requirement that due process be observed before a professional review action is taken.
Well, that's pretty unique, isn't it, for a statute to create an exception to a constitutional requirement?
Well, in the context of professional review actions, it's not a constitutional requirement that due process be
Well, now, whenever I hear the phrase due process, somehow my mind gets clouded by the concept that it's a constitutional principle.
That's true. And, you know, mine does too. But if you look at the Health Quality Improvement Act, there are four standards that must be met. The third standard, in order to get immunity, the third standard is that the hospital or the peer reviewers must afford the practitioner, in effect, due process, notice and hearing, and other procedures before they impose the professional review action. That's where the due process right is established. When you're talking about immunity. But in that same statute, it says there is an exception that you can impose a summary suspension before notice and a hearing if failure to impose a summary suspension may result in imminent danger to health and safety. I think that's the word.
And as I understand your earlier argument, there needs to be a reasonable objective standard about what would constitute imminent danger, correct? It's an objective standard.
Yes.
Okay. And if I understand your position correctly, in this case, the trial judge did not err when he found that on the basis of the undisputed facts, he could not conclude that it was unreasonable to impose a suspension on these immediate suspension on these facts. And that gives rise to immunity for the defendants. Is that correct?
That's not what he said.
All right, well, tell me then what he said.
He said, based upon the circumstances surrounding this matter, it was not unreasonable for Werner to believe that failure to impose the summary suspension would not result in imminent danger.
Okay.
And that's really the standard.
All right. Well, maybe you can help me, because I don't really see intuitively why having a reporter standing in the room assuming they're appropriately sterilized and what have you in terms of their clothing, why having that reporter standing in the room may result in imminent danger to the health of any individual. Tell me, you know, give me a scenario. What does that reporter do that may result in imminent danger to somebody's health?
The question is not necessarily this particular instance. I mean, what can the reporter do? If you talk to a surgeon, he will say that there's lots of things that could happen that could cause harm to a patient from a reporter being in the OR. First off, the reporter is not a trained professional.
But I understand that med students are allowed to do this.
Right. Med students are allowed to do it because they've got some background in sterile techniques, and they've got some background in medical procedures. The problem with the reporter is not the fact that that the reporter's presence in the operating room caused imminent danger. It's the fact that the disruptive conduct of Dr. Sternberg in sneaking this reporter into the operating room posed imminent danger.
Okay, well, and I think I understand that, and I could certainly understand how the executive committee would find it very difficult dealing with Dr. Sternberg because he was not listening to what they were telling him to do. But the Stravinsky case or whatever it is, in that case, the disruptive behavior was one doctor either asking for or actually taking a metal shield from another doctor while a surgery was going on. And I can pretty easily see where that kind of disruption that, first of all, stops a procedure because there's interaction between two doctors who are fighting over a piece of equipment, and second of all, that the piece of equipment itself, its presence or absence might lead to imminent danger of health. So that scenario certainly makes sense to qualify as a kind of disruption that leads to imminent danger. On the other hand, a person standing there, and I gather they found out that he or she was a newspaper reporter because she started taking notes, but there's nothing to suggest that this person was interfering in any way with whatever surgical procedure was going on or doing anything, you know, asking the doctor questions in the middle of the procedure and distracting him that way or anything. So what is it about just being there that qualifies under a standard of may result in imminent danger?
Well, the issue is if you don't suspend, would it result in imminent danger? That's the issue. You don't have to find that there was actual imminent danger before you impose a summary suspension. You only have to determine that if you don't impose a summary suspension, then imminent danger may result.
Well, what are the limits of that? Can't it be any type of potential disagreement with a doctor or failure to just be polite? I mean, where do you go with that?
It's settled. I mean, it's always been the issue is does the disruptive behavior actually have to harm somebody before you can suspend a physician? And the issue has been somewhat resolved because both the AMA and the Joint Commission as well as a number of court cases, have determined that disruptive behavior has the potential to harm patients, that it leads, it's been shown to lead to the possibility of substandard care. And the reason why it does is that teamwork is required in the effective running of a hospital. And disruptive behavior is usually behavior that causes this disruptions in this teamwork, or it causes hospital personnel not to be able to practice to their fullest capacity, or interferes with the procedure somehow.
I think Justice Ridgely's, Justice Ridgely's question implies, can it just be done by fiat? Does there have to be some rational, factual basis to link the disruptive behavior to imminent danger, to disrupting the team, or to future patients? And that may turn on, what does the word may mean? Does may mean likely? Or does that mean under any conceivable scenario there might be harm in the future?
I think Justice Berger had it right. She said it
she could usually happen. Does. I'll concede that.
It could happen. Okay. May seems it could happen. May happen. Could happen. You don't have to prove that it's going to happen.
Okay.
Before you,
so you would reject,
impose a summary suspension.
You would reject likely in the sense of a legal probability, as we use the term probability. It's just speculatively could happen. There's got to be case law on this, as contentious as doctors and hospitals aren't today.
The case law says that you don't have to find that harm occurred in order to impose a summary suspension. You only have to determine that if you don't do the summary suspension, then it may result in imminent danger to the health and safety of someone. May result.
Okay, and in your...
In that case, I guess it would be speculative.
Okay, and your position is on the facts of this case, the trial judge correctly determined, A, there was no genuine issue of material fact in dispute, and correctly granted summary judgment to the defendants?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Now, neither of you have addressed the issue of the appropriate award of attorney's fees, which at least to me is an intriguing issue. I don't know if my colleagues want to deal with it or not. If it's okay with you, I'd give each side 5 minutes on that.
Thank you, Justice.
And the focus, at least in my mind, is on whether or not an award of attorney's fees, as the brief suggests, sua sponte, without application, is appropriate.
Thank you. If I may just briefly in 30 seconds respond to a question Justice Ridgely asked me about Jenkins. If you read the facts of that case, Justice, some of the facts behind the temporary suspension is that the physician was given syringes to nursing staff with air bubbles in it to inject into patients. And it was that finding of imminent danger that was the basis for the temporary suspension, among other conduct. As far as the attorney's fees issue, Your Honor, the attorney's fees application was inappropriate. In order to...
Was there an application?
There was no application. I mean, the application by the court of attorney's fees. In this case, there was a counterclaim. Count two of the counterclaim by defendants was to ask for attorney's fees under the Health Care Quality Improvement Act. Our motion for summary judgment was to strike that counterclaim. There was no request in defendant's papers to the court to impose attorney's fees.
But there was a claim for attorney's fees.
There was a counterclaim, count two, for attorney's fees that we sought to have stricken because if immunity doesn't exist, then there's no basis for attorney's fees.
And your motion was denied.
Our motion was denied. That's correct.
So the attorney's fees counterclaim remained.
It did remain, but there was no briefing or hearing on the point. The court below decided on two bases why it felt that attorney's fees were appropriate, because after the party prevails, the court's got to determine whether there's frivolousness or bad faith. And the court below indicated that frivolousness was based on legal arguments that allege that plaintiff made that respectfully plaintiff did not make.
All of the rationale of the trial judge was without the benefit of any briefing?
Without the benefit of, we touched upon the attorney's fees issue briefly. The opposed defendants had, in their counterclaim, indicated that their basis for bad faith, if I recall the counterclaim, was that we were alleging defamation by implication and other causes of action, which it claimed had no basis in Delaware law. As I recall their counterclaim, that was the basis.
Can I ask you, because it seems to me the trial court decided on attorney's fees for basically one reason, and that was because you resolved your dispute and the hospital gave your client back his privileges and called his time out something other than a suspension, and he continued to work there for another year and then apparently resigned voluntarily, at least based upon this record. So to turn around and sue for the same alleged wrongs that were resolved, I think the trial court determined was bad faith, period. And why is that analysis wrong?
Certainly. Two things. First of all, we didn't have an opportunity to brief that particular issue to the court below. But as to why it was wrong, the resolution that Dr. Sternberg and the hospital accepted from the hospital was to mitigate his damages. As Justice Steele had noted, a precautionary suspension carries very harmful impact on a physician.
Well, wait a second. If it was to mitigate his damages, why didn't he leave a month after the matter had been resolved?
Because he had his own private practice in Seaford. He had a patient base. So for him to end his practice and move someplace else would be to start from scratch. He was trying to recover his practice that had been harmed by the imposition of the precautionary suspension inappropriately.
So you're saying he had to stay with this hospital if he wanted to practice medicine?
He didn't have to stay with the hospital if he wanted to practice medicine, but in order to close a practice and transition, it takes time. It's not something you can do immediately. First of all, you have an obligation to your patients, and he had a patient base. Secondly, it's closing practice and moving elsewhere requires additional effort.
Were any documents signed in connection with the resolution of the suspension?
There was no settlement agreement. There was no release. There was no waiver of claims. Dr. Sternberg, from the moment of the precautionary suspension, sought counsel. He sought Delaware counsel, but the counsel he approached had conflicts. We found us in Philadelphia. We contacted the hospital and informed their attorney that the precautionary suspension was inappropriate. There was no factual basis, which turned out to be we would submit the case after we deposed the witnesses, that the precautionary suspension, if it lasted longer than 30 days, the hospital by law was required to report it to the National Physicians Data Bank. That report would remain on Dr. Sternberg's record forever. Anytime he sought privileges at any hospital, anytime he sought a license in a different state.
Thank you.
Okay. That's the 5 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hackett, 5 minutes if you want to address that issue.
You know, there was the plaintiff had filed a motion for summary judgment on the defendant's counterclaim for attorney's fees, and that motion was extensively briefed. The court had asked the question about, is it appropriate to award attorney's fees sua sponte? If you look at the statute that allows for award of attorney's fees, it says specifically that at the conclusion of the proceedings, the court shall award attorney's fees if certain conditions exist. So the proceedings had concluded. It was time for the court to award the attorney's fees. Now, Dr. Sternberg argues that he was supposed to mitigate damages. So you know, it can't be thrown up against him that the hospital was giving him a bone here, some great deal, and he, you know, and he bit him for it. He had every opportunity to mitigate his damages. When he was, the recommendation of revocation was imposed, he was given the opportunity to take a leave of absence in lieu of it. This was repeated again in early October.
So is it your position that you get your attorney's fees under the bad faith segment of the statute, or because the action was frivolous, or whatever? The court
awarded the attorney's fees because he found that the claims were unreasonable and unfounded, and he found that the claims were brought in bad faith. That was the stated reasoning.
Right. What's your position?
Well, I obviously agree with the judge.
Well, it took the judge 57 pages of a 62-page opinion to address the issues, and I assume that there was extensive briefing on both sides. Doesn't that speak in the direction that at least there's an argument to be made in good faith in support of Dr. Sternberg's claims?
I don't think so. There was no reason for this action to be brought. Normally, physicians have to bring these types of actions if for no other reason but to clear up their record, because it's damaging to a physician to have a suspension or a revocation on the record. And the courts have said even if they don't have a valid claim, they're justified in bringing this action to try to save their careers. He didn't have that here. He didn't have that reason. His record was cleaned up. There was no reason for him.
Apparently, he felt like he had damages in terms of lost.
Well, he said he felt he had damages, but he says he had damages because the summary suspension was published to the community.
Well, the reason
it was published to the community by him because he was talking about it in the newspaper. And there's no reason that he'd be permitted to bring this action to recover damages that he caused himself.
Otherwise, the peer review action is considered confidential, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And there's nothing on the record that...
In the record that he put this in the newspapers himself?
Yes. Yes. If you look in the appendix, there's a copy of the newspaper article. It was about 4 or 5 days, I think, after he was suspended. And there was considerable discovery taken by us where we were asking who breached the confidentiality. Who at the hospital breached confidentiality here and announced to the community that he was suspended, and there was never any response.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.